This episode of the Gospel Coalition podcast is sponsored by the Good Book Company, inviting you to check out God's Word for You, a series of expository guides through books of the Bible for reading, feeding, and leading, with titles by Tim Keller, David Helm, and others. Visit www.thegoodbook.com for more. This is the Gospel Coalition podcast, where we seek to renew the contemporary church in the ancient gospel of Jesus Christ. I'm your host, Colin Hansen. Today's podcast is a talk by Gregory Thornberry on Sigmund Freud's relationship with his pastor. It's a cautionary tale that was recorded at our recent national conference in Indianapolis.
It's a great privilege to be here. Anytime I'm in a conference like this and I'm surrounded by so many pastors, it sort of flashbacks to Nam, because I grew up a preacher's kid. My father, John Thornberry, was the pastor of the Winfield Baptist Church outside of Lewisburg, Pennsylvania, for 44 years in the same congregation. And I was reminded of this story as I've talked to so many pastors coming in, that when my father went to that church in 1966, he didn't, by the way, for those of you Puritan fans, American Puritan fans, he didn't beat Noah Porter's record, which I think was 60 years, but 44 years ain't bad. And I went to his retirement celebration a few years ago, and I talked to a man that was one of the original deacons when he came, well up in years. His name was Guy Dwyer. And I said, do you remember when my father first came to the church? And he said, I remember it vividly. I remember the first sermon your dad preached. And I said, what was the first sermon? And he said, you must be born again. And he said, it was at that moment that I felt the church begin to awaken. So we're talking about a pastor today. And for those of you whose job it is to discharge your ministry, while, you know, pointy-headed academics like me are telling you to engage culture, I will enter into the record this cautionary tale for us all about a man named Oscar Pfister, who I provocatively sent in the title to the organizers of this conference. They invited me to speak. They said the theme was No Other Gospel. And they said, could you have something along those lines that you could do? And I said, sure. They said, well, send us in your description for your talk. And I just sent in two words, Freud's pastor. I think that disturbed some of the organizers of the conference. They did not want a lecture on Sigmund Freud and the Oedipal complex, I think, at the No Other Gospel theme conference. But I think actually this particular, by the way, there's a seat up here in the front, two, three seats if somebody wants to come sit down. There's a seat here, there's two in the middle here, there's some down the front if you want to. Raise your hand if you are next to an empty seat. So I'm one of those preacher's kids that had heard so many sermons growing up, and there were many passages that bothered me in the Bible, or phrases that disturbed me in the Bible. One of which is in 2 Timothy 3:5, having the form of godliness, but denying the power thereof. Now that is scary, to have the form of godliness, but denying the power thereof. And the description of the kinds of people that are characterized by having the form of godliness but denying the power thereof in the preceding verses, verses 1 through 4 of 2 Timothy 3, are, let's just say, pithy, poignant, and trenchant for the times in which we live. You might want to look it up later. But I've thought a lot about this story of Oscar Pfister, who I'll talk about in a moment, and his relationship to Sigmund Freud. But I think a lot about this text and what it means for Christians trying to do cultural engagement. I just completed my next book, which is a biography, a critical biography, of the Jesus Movement Poet Laureate and rock icon Larry Norman. He had long, flowing blonde hair like Gandalf, wore motorcycle leather, and sang about Jesus on Capitol Records and on mainstream music labels before there was any such thing as Jesus rock. As a matter of fact, he started Christian rock music, which became this Frankenstein-type beast that we're still dealing with today. But in the course, I had access to Larry's whole archive. And I came across this notebook entry from 1974, in which he went to the Hollywood Beverly Hills apartment of Denny Cordell, who's a famous rock and roll record producer. He produced J.J. Cale, Tom Petty, made a lot of, you know, big discoveries. But he was also the producer for Leon Russell. And Leon Russell just passed away. He's a great blues musician. And Denny Cordell was talking to Larry Norman. He said, "Now, what do you do?" And Larry said, "I sing about Jesus, but, you know, I play rock." And Denny Cordell said, "Oh, well, that's kind of what Leon Russell does. But he does it a little bit differently, because he spent years going to black churches and studying the call and response, the way in which the music was played. And his goal was for people to come to a Leon Russell concert and be saved in the name of Leon Russell, to have a religious experience while they were there, having the form of godliness, but denying the power thereof." And I think that story was brought to mind again when I began reading the story of Oscar Pfister, who was born in 1873, died in 1956. A former student of mine from Union University that went on to do a PhD in psychoanalysis at the Sorbonne said, "Have you ever heard of this correspondence between this Swiss Lutheran pastor who was very close friends with Sigmund Freud?" I had not. And I began diving in, and the correspondence between Freud and this pastor is preserved for the record in a book entitled Psychoanalysis and Faith. And Oscar Pfister was quite the Renaissance man. In many ways, he'd be envied by us. His credentials would be envied by us. He graduated from the University of Zurich in 1898 with a degree in philosophy, where he did work in 19th century German idealism. He then went on to become ordained as a minister in the Swiss Lutheran Church in the canton of Zurich. He was a polymath. He was a pastor. He was a secondary school teacher. He was a scholar of astonishing magnitude. He was a psychoanalyst and a voluminous academically published writer in the field of psychoanalysis. He was closely associated in Zurich to Bleugler and Carl Jung, Edwin Bleugler and Carl Jung, who started a school of psychoanalysis in Zurich. And he became the pastor of the Predigerkirche in Zurich from 1902 to 1939. So not quite John Thornbury level, but close. A faithful pastor who is preaching. And he was a founding member of the Swiss Society for Psychoanalysis. He was also a professor at the Cantonal Teaching Academy from 1908 to 1918. So the next time you're feeling like you're slacking a little bit, just remember Pastor Pfister, who was a real workaholic, I would say. But the most notable thing about him was a lifelong very real and long-standing friendship with Sigmund Freud. Oscar Pfister wrote the very first textbook that was a secondary source after Freud's writings that described Freud's psychoanalytic method. He was the first person to write a definitive textbook on Freud's method called the psychoanalytic method. And Freud was astonished that this Swiss Lutheran pastor, and by the way, just for those of you who are wondering, he was not, as far as I can tell, Oscar Pfister was not in any way liberal. He had not sold out the claims of the gospel or the authority of the Bible. He had not been melted down by the acids of modernity. From everything that I can tell, he was basically orthodox. But Freud was taken with the fact that here's this pastor who in some ways was just a lay scholar in the field of psychoanalysis, that the first textbook on Freud's psychoanalytic method would be from this pastor and that it would be so accurate. One of the things that we definitely need to be doing in our environment of conversations with people of secular persuasion is that when we describe their views, when they hear it, they say, that is exactly what I think. Not a twist on it, not rhetorical. There's a seat right down here, brother, if you want to come. Are you sure? You know, we are told when we take our philosophy classes in seminary that the classic Christian position on truth is the correspondence theory of truth, right? Where what we say in terms of propositional statements mirrors reality. Well, we need to have the correspondence theory of truth too when it comes to people who don't share our views. So Freud was taken with Pfister, and Pfister sent he was a hiker, and Pfister sent Freud a little metal replica of the Matterhorn, and it stayed on Freud's desk until the day that Freud died. Even more importantly, Oscar Pfister would make sorties, he would make frequent visits to Austria, and he became a very close family friend of the Freud family. Now, for any of you that have done studies of these seminal thinkers in modern thought, and Freud is one of the three high priests of modernity, right? Darwin, Freud, and Marx, you know, are sort of the three high priests. But when you read about people like Rousseau or you read about Marx and you look at their family lives, they're horrendous. But Freud's family basically stayed intact, and Pfister was a part of the family life for three decades. Okay? So this is no passing phenomenon. The Freud children loved this pastor. He was the most welcome visitor in their house. And as you know, Freud himself was filled with all kinds of neuroses and was paranoid himself. Everybody was out to get him. The one person that he felt safe with in his home was Oscar Pfister. And Pfister would bring this light and joy and calm and happiness into the home. So much so that when this book, Psychoanalysis and Faith, came out, was published, one of the essays at the beginning of the book was written by Anna Freud, who was, you know, significant researcher in psychoanalysis in her own right, and she attests to the fact that Freud or and Pfister had this relationship, and that Pfister was this welcome part of their home. At one point in this correspondence, Freud complains that the children probably would prefer for Pfister to be their father rather than Freud, because Pfister would take them hiking and Freud didn't really like to do, you know, his work was too important. And so he even kind of expressed some jealousy at the role that Pfister had with his own children. More than that, Freud admired Pfister's scholarship immensely and profited from it. And he was bemused and intrigued by the fact that Pfister was not combative, and that, as a matter of fact, Pfister thought that there were profound areas of overlap between Freud's research and a biblical worldview. And at one point, Freud was very, very taken with an essay that had been written by Pfister on Nicholas Ludwig von Zinzendorf, the founder of the Moravian Brethren. Now, you think about this. This is in the 1920-ish. Pfister publishes this article in one of Freud's collections on Zinzendorf, and it's a very controversial look into the life of Zinzendorf in which Pfister suggests that Zinzendorf was a homosexual. Right? No extra charge, just another little comment. You can talk about that with your church history professors some other time, okay? But Freud said, despite the fact that you make this claim about Zinzendorf, this kind of, bombshell kind of claim, we're going to publish it anyway. Yeah, interesting. I think there was a Bonhoeffer biography that kind of went down this route. Freud also loved Pfister's loyalty as a friend. When you think about friendship, one of the most important things about friendship is, who's got your back and loyalty. And for those of you that have studied the history of psychology, there was the Swiss school of psychoanalysis, and there was this Austrian school. The Swiss school, Bleugler and Jung, was its own society, and they were very much opposed to Freudian theories. And Pfister was a member of the Swiss Psychoanalytic Association with Jung, and Jung was the paterfamilias of this. Pfister resigned from Jung's Psychoanalytic Association and started a new Swiss Psychoanalytic Association to disseminate the views of Freud. And Freud was like, wow, this is impressive. This guy is really on our side. And you can read Freud. Freud was almost obsessed with writing Pfister. This book is, 150 pages long. And there was this real academic back and forth between Pfister and Freud. And you think about, talk about loyalty. Knowing that maybe his best friend was this Lutheran pastor who deeply believed in the claims of Christianity, and Freud was notoriously atheist, and wrote Totem and Taboo and a book on Moses, in which he really deconstructs the whole biblical record from the standpoint of neuroses and psychoanalysis and biology. In 1927, Freud writes a book called The Future of an Illusion. Of course, you know what that book's about. The illusion is the gospel. The illusion is the religious impulse. The illusion is Christianity itself. So the book is titled The Future of an Illusion, in which Freud says this is what is going to happen as religion completely passes away from the scene and psychoanalysis takes over as the new unified field theory through which we can understand the primal urges and neuroses and therapeutic treatments for the human condition. Pfister responded with his own book called The Illusion of a Future. And he kind of punches back. He responds to Freud's characterization that there was absolutely no compatibility between traditional Judeo-Christian truth claims and his own research in psychoanalysis. And for any of you that want that, I'd be happy to send that that book to you. It's in the public domain as a PDF. And Pfister really does engage in apologetics in this book. He is not accommodating to the claims of Freud, or seeking to make peace with him where there was no peace. As a matter of fact, Freud was a little miffed that Pfister wrote this response. But there is a reason why I titled this talk Freud's Pastor, because it's really actually a play on words. Of course, you know, Sigmund Freud was an atheistic Jew, and he did not attend church. So in a way, Pfister was not Freud's pastor. What I mean to say is that at the end of the day, despite all of their discussions, the time in the home, correspondence, and this interplay between the future of an illusion and the illusion of a future, Freud at the end of the day owned Oscar Pfister. He was Freud's pastor. Freud's worldview at the end of the day wins out in this interchange and display of ideas. And herein, the reason why I wanted to talk about this in the No Other Gospel themed conference is that I think that we find in here a cautionary tale that we are constantly being told to engage culture, right? To be well-read in the resources and the ideas and the political views and the philosophy of our time and our culture. And I am chief amongst them that have done this, all right? So I'm preaching to myself, right? I am concerned, as my friend David Dark has said, that when we say you should engage culture, we don't realize that we are so in deep in culture ourselves. As David Dark says, you know, engage culture, guess what? You're soaking in it already. It's not as though culture is somehow out here over here, and, you know, we're like Gandalf, you know, imperiously looking down at the orcs into Helm's Deep. That's how we think of cultural engagement. You know, like the bad, dirty world is down there, and we will thunder from our blogs, you know, from the mountaintops of our blogs, and we will hail down oil, boiling oil, various different things, waiting for Aragorn to arrive. This analogy is breaking down at this point. But there is a risk that we run by thinking of cultural engagement as something that we sort of, from a, you know, religiously neutral point of view, sit back and take all this in. We need to be very careful about how our own understanding of the gospel might be subtly changed or move just a few degrees or lose the angularity that that tangential prophetic word that breaks in from the outside in our attempts to engage with culture. For some of you, you will have come across the name of a Dutch philosopher, Christian philosopher, who's sort of made a comeback in recent years. He was sort of out of fashion for a time, and now he's come back. Herman Dooyeweerd. Francis Schaeffer infelicitously called him Dooyeweerd. But he is, maybe that was more apt, because he wrote this massive, multi-volume, new critique of theoretical thought based upon modal aspects of reality. And basically put, Dooyeweerd's key insight was his definition of religion and how the various different disciplines of modern academic scholarship have a fundamentally religious nature at its core. Okay? So for those of you taking notes, paraphrasing, and this is Roy Clauser's paraphrase, religion is the belief in something or other as divine. Okay? Now that's a controversial definition because anthropologists would take issue with it, but this is basically Dooyeweerd's view. Religion is the belief in something or other as divine, and divine is defined as something that has the status of not being dependent on anything else. So religion is the belief in something or other as divine, and divine is defined as something that has the status of not being dependent on anything else. In other words, it's bedrock. It's foundational. And what Dooyeweerd was able to do is show how Freud took the psychic aspect, modality, of reality and turned the psychic or psychological aspect and the biological aspect out and made that the fundamental presuppositional norm out of which everything else could be read. And so there is always, according to Dooyeweerd, for every anti-biblical worldview, a radix, a root, that takes the place of the divine. And the cautionary tale from the life of Pfister, for me, is that despite his pushback, despite his give and take, despite his interaction and critique of various different aspects of Freud's worldview, at no point does he seem to come to grips with the fact that at the root, at the basic fundamental bedrock level of presuppositions, that the worldview of Freud's understanding of the Oedipal complex and neuroses was fundamentally at odds with the gospel. And Pfister himself, over time, began to change the way he talked about the good news, to the point that the fundamental insight of Jesus' teaching about the kingdom of God was not something that had to do with atonement or sin, but that it had to do with the fact that Jesus' teaching about the kingdom freed people from their neuroses about the Father, the anxiety and the desires, Freud said, to kill the Father. It freed one up from the fear of religion and replaced it with faith in God. So the gospel for Pfister has something to do with a Freudian archetype which is fundamentally flawed at its very core. And so at the end of the day, here is a man with a I could be wrong about this. There could be new information that comes to light, because I understand there's a new edition of this correspondence between Pfister and Freud that is coming out, where more letters from Pfister are represented. But as I have read through this correspondence and have read about this relationship, what worries me even more than the apologetic side and the nature of starting points, presuppositional starting points, is that I don't see any evidence that Pfister ever made claims on Freud's soul for Christ. I see no evidence that he directly preached the gospel to him. William F. Buckley Jr. once defined conservatism as standing athwart history, saying no to progressive ideas. That's what conservatism is. And an apologist is not an apologist unless he stands athwart the public square saying, repent and believe in the good news, for the kingdom of God is at hand. And so over three decades, I have not yet found concrete evidence that Pfister ever pressed for conversion. And so he was Freud's pastor. He was owned by a worldview that was alien to his own. I want to close, and then we'll have some time for questions and answers and thoughts, because I think that's more important than me just talking the whole time. But as some of you know, I published a book a couple of years ago on someone who was very much instrumental in helping save my own faith when it was in crisis, Carl F. H. Henry, who many of you would know is the first editor of Christianity Today, but really a titanic intellect and really the greatest philosophical theologian evangelicalism had in the 20th century. If you read Henry's magnum opus, which Crossway, thank you, and Al Mohler, thank you, wherever you are, back in 1998, Al got a burr under his saddle to republish God, Revelation, and Authority as a set. It had never come out as it never came out as a set, and Crossway did it. You know, without any hopes that it would actually be a seller, you know. I actually think it did become a pretty good seller for them over a period of time. When you read that, you see, here is Henry, and this is the thing as a young person that attracted me to Carl Henry. He is reading Gadamer and Wittgenstein and Nietzsche and Kierkegaard at a very deep level. He is engaging with the texts of the New Criticism, with Bultmann and Barthes. He's immersed in these texts. He's doing battle with them. The highest of high scholarship. And if I would have only known that about Carl Henry, that would have been legend enough for me. But by God's grace, I had a chance to, in the last few years that Carl was alive, get to know him personally. Paul House, the Old Testament theologian, and I wrote a golly gee whiz bang note to Carl Henry back in 1997, saying, we are so grateful for you. And he wrote back and said, come visit me in Watertown, Wisconsin, which is where he retired because his wife, Helga, didn't want him to be close to a major airport anymore. That's a good strategy, all right? For those of you spouses, get your fellow off the road. He's got to travel 2 hours to get to the airport. And they lived at I'm not making this up. This is Reformation year. Carl Henry, during his retirement years, lived at 1141 Huss Drive in Watertown, Wisconsin. But I was able to spend time with him out in just everyday life, in public, and at restaurants, at Cracker Barrel, which nearly gave Dr. Mohler an aneurysm when he found out that we brought in Carl Henry and I took him out to Cracker Barrel for dinner. I never was with Carl Henry in public that he didn't try to win whoever he was talking to Christ. And we brought him to a PhD seminar in Louisville to Southern Seminary, where, you know, 30 years before he was on campus and they would not let him speak in the PhD seminar, the most widely published evangelical scholar of his time. He was not allowed to speak. He was only allowed to listen into the vaunted PhD seminar at Southern Seminary on systematic theology. But this time, Carl was allowed to speak, and we were reading Pannenberg's third volume of his systematic theology that had just come out. And Andy Davis, who's now the pastor of First Baptist Church, Durham, North Carolina, go Tar Heels, I guess. That's Duke. I don't know. I don't care. It's all North Carolina to me. Sorry, David. But Andy Davis asked this question: What is the most pressing question that you think is confronting theologians working in contemporary theology in the modern field? What's the key question? And Carl Henry didn't bat an eyelash. He said the same fundamental question with which the apostles juxtaposed to an ancient pagan world: have you met the resurrected Lord? That's the combination of the height of awareness and scholarship and motivation, and yet an understanding that at the end of the day, the exclusive claims of Christ have to be brought upon men and women of both high and low estate. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the Gospel Coalition podcast. For more gospel-centered resources, visit thegospelcoalition.org.